Hello, it's Tom here. We'll get into the latest episode of Last Orders in just one moment. But before we do that, I just want to remind you of a great way that you can support this show, and that is by leaving us a glowing five-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. It takes you just 30 seconds, but it's a great way to help the show and make sure that it reaches more people. I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who's been sending in their postbag questions. We've really enjoyed answering them on the show. If you'd like to send in your questions to me and to Christopher and be in with a chance to get them answered on the next episode, do send them to lastorders@spiked-online.com. That's lastorders@spiked-online.com, or you can message us on social media. Thanks so much, and now back to the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss Britain's backdoor blasphemy laws, the panic over youth vaping, and Chris's triumph over Jonathan Portes. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom. Hello, listeners.
And we're delighted to be joined today by Liam Duffy. Liam is an advisor for the Counter-Extremism Project, a US-based think tank, and also writes widely on issues of extremism and counterterrorism. Liam, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for the invite.
So, Liam, we're going to start with you, because the reason I wanted to get you on today was to talk about what I think is one of the most kind of like profound threats to liberalism and certainly freedom of speech in this country, but doesn't really seem to be given its due and talked about nearly enough, which is that of these creeping backdoor Islamic blasphemy laws that we've seen rear their ugly head, most recently with the Wakefield scandal, but something that we've seen at Batley Grammar, something that we saw with the Lady of Heaven protest recently. Now, there's been a lot of discussion about this in recent weeks, so maybe it's worth just me laying the ground a little bit quickly for people who have been living under a rock, but essentially it's really come to the fore because of this scandal in Wakefield. We had this group of young boys at school who one of them on a dare brings in a copy of the Quran. Long story short, it gets knocked to the floor and scuffed. This unleashes a horrendous kind of local scandal, effectively, where you see rumours swirling online that it'd been desecrated, promoted, in fact, by local Labour councillors. You saw the local imam effectively going to the school suspending the students. You also had the police becoming involved and logging this Quran scuffing as a non-crime hate incident, and it culminating in this now kind of viral meeting at the local mosque in Wakefield, where you had one of the boys' mothers effectively pleading for the safety of her son, saying that he had received death threats, but she wouldn't take them further provided his security was guaranteed. So it just gave a really stark insight for many people about the fact that when an accusation of blasphemy is made, even if it's young children, even if it's people who really weren't doing anything necessarily that untoward, certainly not anything hateful, it can very quickly spiral out of control. So whilst there's been a lot of discussion about this already, was there anything about the Wakefield scandal in particular that struck you, something we haven't spoke about enough? What was your sort of main response to it, I guess?
Shocked but not surprised, I guess, because I think this kind of thing has been coming for a while. And well, I'll come back to this, but I think it's really important to join the dots and join what happened in Wakefield to a bunch of other incidents. You mentioned one of them, the Lady of Heaven. I think there's been some interesting chatter, like online, saying, you know, we don't have the full facts of what happened at the school. You know, we don't know if the school was right to, you know, discipline the students or whatever. And you know, maybe there's some truth to that. Maybe there were bigger behavioural issues and things like that. But that just strikes me as a bit cowardly, like not wanting to look in the face what actually happened. And, you know, even if more information does come out about the original non-incident, the fact is that a bunch of people, including one of the students' mothers you mentioned, a police officer and kind of local elected officials, all gathered at a religious institute, a local mosque, basically in order to explain what had happened and, like you said, apologize, plead. Because looming over this whole situation is the both implicit and explicit threat of potential unrest or violence. And that's what it comes down to, is that event happened because of the risk of unrest or violence. And that's, you know, no other facts that come into this will change that.
And it was something that was admitted quite openly at the meeting itself. You know, you had the local imam effectively saying, we don't want to see any violence, but at the same time, we will lay our lives on the line and so on. So that meeting wouldn't have happened if that threat of violence didn't exist. But do you want to say a bit more about some of the dots that we should connect here, the other stories that have been building up in recent years? Because I know this is something that you've been drawing attention to, the longer history beyond just Wakefield or Batley or the more recent cases that we have been talking about and kind of easily remember, I guess.
You know, as you know, and most people will know, Islam and the global Muslim population is not a monolith. There's all sorts of sects and denominations and movements and political denominations within those movements. Basically, there's been a bit of an arms race, for want of a better phrase, on blasphemy since, you know, the first out of the blocks, to mix metaphors, was Ayatollah Khomeini back in 1989 with the fatwa against Salman Rushdie. Obviously, since then, that in itself really changed everything, because that put the entire world, including non-Muslims, under, you know, Ayatollah Khomeini's self-proclaimed Islamic jurisdiction. But since then, other parties have joined the fray, like Al-Qaeda with the Charlie Hebdo attack. Then ISIS and ISIS supporters have joined the fray with the assassination of Samuel Paty, the schoolteacher, just outside Paris. But there's also another party which more recently in the last few years has joined this theological arms race on blasphemy, is called Barelvism, which is, it's not exactly a sect or a denomination, and I'm really going to test the limits of my expertise here, but it's a movement within Islam which originates in Pakistan. So within Barelvism in Pakistan, what's been happening is Barelvism as a movement has always been devoted to the Prophet, Muhammad, but there's been a bit of, for want of a better word, radicalization within Barelvism in the last few years, which means that basically they've taken to accusing other sects or other movements of Islam, such as Diabandis, Salafis, political Islamists like Jamaat-e-Islami or the Muslim Brotherhood, of not sufficiently respecting or, you know, devoting themselves to the Prophet. So a lot of the kind of blasphemy fervor that you see in Pakistan, when you see massive kind of horizon-spanning rallies and stuff like that, comes from this movement within Barelvism. And with 40 to 50% of British Muslims being Barelvis, what's happened is that some of that zeal for blasphemy has come into the UK through the Pakistani diaspora. What's important for like institutions like the school, like the police, like the council in these incidents is, blasphemy is obviously a bit of a catch-all phrase that we use, like an anglicized term, but you know, you could find yourself at the center of one of these affairs without ever hearing anyone utter the word blasphemy, because, you know, there's all sorts of offenses within Islam that could fall under what we would understand as blasphemy. I think the one that kind of exercises and animates the kind of more animated sections of the Barelvi population is the idea of disrespecting or insulting the Prophet. So that's what we've seen in some of the other affairs, like the first glimpse of it was the murder of Asad Shah, the shopkeeper, in 2016 in Glasgow, by a man from Bradford. Then we've seen, as you said, the Batley schoolteacher affair surrounding the use of Charlie Hebdo cartoons in a lesson, the Lady of Heaven film that was pulled from cinemas, and now this Wakefield incident. So it's all, you know, they're all connected, and it's emanating, this particular thread of it is emanating from kind of far-right political movements in Pakistan.
That's a really useful overview, and also pointing out, which is not often pointed out, which is this is effectively a kind of, as you say, a sort of far-right political movement as much as anything else. The amount of sensitivity which is being shown to what is, for all intents and purposes, that is quite striking. I said one thing that I've been particularly preoccupied by, whilst I completely take your point that there's a global context to this, there's a broader question about the way in which you have, broadly speaking, kind of global Islamic and other cases Islamist movements who are pushing a particular anti-blasphemy agenda. Just the stark cowardice on behalf of British liberal secular allegedly society that we've seen, not just in recent years but really for the past 30 years, I mean since the Satanic Verses controversy onwards, just a constant capitulation. I mean, it only ever really seems to be that people can summon the minerals to condemn violence and murder when it takes place, which is nice and important, but at the same time this internalization of these codes, so you create a situation where you're at a school in Wakefield and it suddenly spirals out of control to the point where you have a member of the local police nodding sagely whilst an imam talks about how this issue isn't being brushed under the carpet. And as I say, treating this as not only something which these blasphemy codes effectively need to be given into, but also that it literally becomes a police matter. It's really, really chilling. What do you make of that kind of, I guess, the response of British civil society institutions to this particular threat? I mean, how is it? What's driving it? Is it cowardice? Is it something else?
I think in terms of like the police and like local councils, when they've got, or you know, local mayors and other elected officials, you know, I've seen this for myself, that there's a bit of an incapability of seeing the bigger picture. I've got almost no doubt that the people involved there, from like the police to the council, they've probably got no idea that they were at the center of a blasphemy affair, a blasphemy controversy, basically. And what I've seen from working, you know, in local authority settings myself, and working alongside police who are, you know, kind of been willing to engage with unsavory characters, to put it one way, is there's just this completely blinkered mentality for like local community relations and community engagement. And what happens is sometimes those dynamics, local dynamics, as they call it, get put ahead of the health, like the overall health of British democracy. So I think there's a bit of that happening there. And I think there's a bit of just really not realizing what they found themselves at the center of. Because like I said, they may never hear the word blasphemy, not realize that actually this falls into a pattern, going back to these other recent events in Britain, but also, you know, the longer history that you've mentioned as well. In terms of like the general kind of, yeah, establishment liberal cowardice, I think going back to the Salman Rushdie affair, I mean, it wasn't just on the liberal side of the spectrum. There were plenty on the religious, in the religious establishment, in the Conservative Party, who were quick to denounce Rushdie because obviously, probably because of his left-wing credentials prior to that affair. But I think since then, with Charlie Hebdo, with Samuel Paty, these other events, yeah, it's been mainly a kind of a liberal failing.
I want to bring Chris in briefly before we move on to some of the other stories that we're going to talk about. But Chris, what was your response to this particular scandal? So if you've just got any questions for Liam here.
Yeah, I found it quite shocking. I did watch the whole video of, you know, this copper up in Wakefield kind of cowering really before this angry cleric. But, you know, you can kind of see why, right? I mean, because he probably was literally scared of a big riot in Wakefield. And that's the thing. People are scared. Lots of people are scared about, you know, offending like fanatical Islamists in this country. It would be nice if we had politicians at the top who really shouldn't be scared and don't really have any real reason to be scared to stand up and say, look, we haven't got blasphemies in this country, and that's all there is to it. And if you really can't be dealing with that, then perhaps Britain isn't the place for you. I have to say, though, it doesn't help that, you know, it's not like Britain is a bastion of free speech in other way, in other respects, you know. So, you know, these people think that it is highly offensive to draw pictures of the Prophet Muhammad or to scuff the Quran or what have you. But we have plenty of things that people can't say in this country because other people find them offensive. So it makes it more difficult, I think, for politicians to say, look, we are a country that believes in free speech, and if you're offended, that's too bad, sticks and stones, because that's not actually what the government thinks.
And it's been interesting as well. I'm not sure if you've noticed this, Liam, but the way in which hardline religious conservatives, Islamist activists even, have kind of latched on to our own culture of offence. So as Chris was pointing to there, we might not have Islamic blasphemy laws in this country. We might not have blasphemy laws at all in the traditional sense, but we do have these new blasphemies, which are policed pretty stringently around offence, around being seen to demean a particular minority community or what have you, the definitions of which have expanded and expanded over recent years. And you saw this very clearly, particularly around the protest outside of Batley Grammar and the Lady of Heaven screenings, where there was this discussion about effectively the image was of Islamists calling for a safe space. Effectively, they would employ the language of Islamophobia, which is effectively to deploy the language of deeming certain opinions racist and so on. Is that something that you've noticed in your work, that there has been this attempt to kind of co-opt our own language of offense taking identity politics to the ends of shutting down what they see as Islamic anti-Islamic blasphemy?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you can go and find current and former members of you know, obviously the most famous Islamist movement in the world is the Muslim Brotherhood, but there are former and current members of the Muslim Brotherhood who have been pretty open and said, you know, we do kind of latch on and exploit or camouflage our objectives, you know, within the kind of progressive umbrella. So, you know, using a lot of decolonial type language on American campuses and, you know, that American campus type language. So, yeah. They've, you know, they're kind of explicit about it and know that stuff, you know, identity politics is, you know, manna from heaven for Islamist groups, because that's what they want. They want to, they want an identity block. They want to present all Muslim populations, all Muslim thought as this kind of monolith that they can legitimately speak on behalf of. That's you know, one of their key objectives in the West. So identity politics serves those objectives very nicely. Now, just to come back to what Chris was saying about, you know, politicians standing up and saying this stuff, like, it's a bit frustrating in a lot of these affairs that, you know, that we've got a conservative government which, you know, is very good at, you know, writing an op-ed or firing off angry tweets about this stuff. But like, that's kind of all you see. It's almost like they sound more like the opposition party than the people with the actual power to do something about this. And even if you go back to the Samuel Paty affair, and I know that was a bit different because that was in the middle of COVID, or just as the world was emerging from COVID in October 2020. But pretty much every European government actually kind of issued some sort of statement of support for France, or, you know, from foreign ministers or prime ministers and presidents and things like that. But Britain was more or less AWOL from what happened during that whole affair, you know, and the aftermath of which France kind of found itself at the middle of an international scandal in the way that Denmark did after the Jyllands-Posten affair as well. So, you know, Britain and the British government has been absent on this in a few different affairs.
Plenty to think about there, Liam, and even though there's so much more we could talk about, we should move on because time is short. Chris, I want to talk about a couple of nanny state stories that you've picked out to discuss on the podcast this week. Should we start with the latest on plain packaging and the latest study supposedly supporting this policy?
Yeah, so there's a growing kind of panic about kids vaping. And to be fair, quite a few kids are vaping now. Not very many of them are smoking, but a lot of them who are vaping have never smoked to begin with. And so obviously, you know, teachers in particular are quite concerned about this. There's been a few stories that no one's really joined the dots, as it were, but there's been quite a few stories about kids having riots in schools. And there is apparently a bit of a TikTok craze for kids starting a riot about anything and then posting the footage on TikTok. But there's also a bit of a craze for kids vaping. And these two things have come together because quite a few of these riots, including one from not far away from where I'm from in North Yorkshire, was due to the teachers shutting the toilets pretty much all day long and not letting kids leave the class to go to the toilet and not even having them open for much of break time. And this was because kids are vaping them all the time. So there is an issue with underage vaping, and I imagine it's only going to get more and more hysterical as time goes on. One of the things that the public health groups would like to do is to make e-cigarettes less appealing. And a couple of weeks ago, a study was published saying that if you put e-cigarettes in plain packaging, they'll be less appealing to kids. And the study was based on just a survey where they mocked up some plain packs and just the same rubbish that they used to get plain packaging for tobacco in the first place. They show the kids some normal cigarette packs, show them some plain cigarette packs. Which one do you find more attractive? Well, obviously the one that's not deliberately ugly. And they go, okay, that means it'll work. It didn't work. Plain packaging didn't make a jot of difference. This has been shown now fairly comprehensively. So we know plain packaging doesn't work. They've come back with the same evidence again to try and do exactly the same thing with e-cigarettes. And one of the things they said while they were doing it for tobacco was, there's no slippery slope, there's no domino effect. Once we've done it with cigarettes, doesn't mean we'll do it with other stuff. And now exactly the same people who were saying that and producing this kind of evidence and arguing for plain packaging for e-cigarettes. So it's yet another story of the slippery slope and junk science. Is it going to make any difference? I would very much doubt it. And you're just going through this same cycle of failure again and again. The answer, you know, insofar as underage vaping is a problem, the answer, I think, is to get training standards to enforce the rules. It does seem very easy for kids to buy e-cigarettes in a way that they don't find it so easy to buy spirits and cigarettes. So I suspect if you went around and started finding a few of these retailers, mostly corner shops, you know, small convenience stores, you started dishing out a few 10 grand fines, I think you would soon clamp down there.
I've got to say, I'm slightly mystified by this kind of youth vaping panic, partly because when you hear these stories about, oh, there's all of these problems in schools and so on, like you say, they're all running off to the toilets to vape in the middle of class or whatever. It's like, you can stop them from doing that. You know, you weren't allowed to smoke in toilets and things. You weren't allowed to smoke at school. Like, there's this kind of weird, you see it with the mobile phone thing as well, this idea that we couldn't possibly, you know, enforce rules against these kinds of things, which I always find a bit strange.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. So they're going overboard by saying, well, kids are vaping in toilets, therefore we'll close the toilets. And this really isn't a sensible solution to anything. You know, if you need to send the teacher in every now and again to see if somebody's vaping, just as they would have done in the old days with people smoking, fair enough, you can do that. And presumably that should be enough, like you say, Tom, to stop kids doing it. Incidentally, I spoke to a teacher about this the other day, and I said, like, is there a lot of your kids vaping? He goes, yeah, to be fair, there is quite a large and growing number. I said, do you see many smoking? He goes, now you mention it, I don't think I've caught kids smoking for ages. So it's definitely some substitution effect here. And I saw some idiot on TV the other day saying that, oh, cigarettes have gone completely out of fashion with kids these days, but they're really keen on vaping, so we need to stop them vaping. Like, you know, there's not kind of a, you know, some trade-off going on here. Is it the worst thing in the world, really, if kids are vaping? You know, of all the things they could be doing, I would say it's probably the most benign. I'm not supporting it. I do think, you know, we should be enforcing the law, but it's just a different order to, you know, teen pregnancies and smoking and drinking and taking drugs.
I know, it's another reminder that some of these kids are a lot more vanilla, really, in their kind of vices than previously. But as you know, I take your point about the fact that the law, if the law's not being enforced, that's of course is a problem. There are age restrictions on things for all kinds of reasons. But I mean, is there a particularly strong, because we know that vaping is overwhelmingly the healthier alternative to smoking for adults. Is there any real evidence that it's a problem for young people whilst we wouldn't want to encourage it, whilst we understand there should be age restrictions and so on? Is the potential health risk worth the panic, I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, I mean, I know. Well, the evidence doesn't suggest there's any real problem other than addiction. You know, if 50% of kids are vaping, I don't think that's a great thing to, you know, for anybody to be getting addicted to nicotine at that kind of age. It is obviously possible some of them will go from that to smoking. It's very unlikely, this gateway effect idea. But when you're dealing with such large numbers, I guess it's inevitable that one or two of them at least will do that. So I suspect it's a bit of a craze. A lot of these kids, as I understand it, aren't even vaping nicotine e-cigarettes anyway. They're just doing it because they like the look of it and they like the flavors. And probably like a lot of other fads, it will become unfashionable at some point. I don't know. But now, as a health problem, you know, it is at the bottom end of the kind of health threats to young people.
Liam, I'm not sure if you've got any hot takes on vaping and plain packaging.
No hot takes on vaping, but just funny to see how different Panics Institute for young people, like, you know, obviously in my line of work, there's different panics about how they're vulnerable to radicalization online because of propaganda and stuff like that. And it's just like the way overblown response. It's just a pattern for everything, it seems.
So, Chris, should we move on to the second sort of nanny state story we're going to talk about, which is your old friend Henry Dimbleby, who has left his position as food czar. He was appointed by the government some years ago to advise on various aspects of food policy, fronted this review, which made all kinds of recommendations. We talked about the show, one of which I think was that GPs should prescribe cabbages and so on. So he definitely got native in the role, as they tend to. But as I say, he's left in protest. He's also got a book out suspiciously the same time. I wouldn't want to draw connections.
Complete coincidence.
But do you want to tell us a little bit about what Henry's been saying of late and what we should make of it?
So he resigned about 3 days before his book came out and got lots of publicity for resigning. This is the thing. When you appoint these bloody people as independent reviewers, this happens all the time. We talked about it several times, you know, the Khan review. You get these random kind of good chaps to effectively decide what the government's policy should be, rather than have, you know, politicians do it, you know, which is their job, or even, you know, approach a think tank or an expert or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But no, they just appoint fairly random people. In this case, a guy who's mostly famous for setting up a junk food chain.
This is Leon, we should say. So junk food for the middle classes.
Leon. Natural fast food, they call it, which actually has a lot of the time has more fat and sugar and calories than McDonald's. But anyway, so they appoint this guy, and of course he goes native and he comes up with some extreme and totally impractical solutions, which I'll come to in a second. And then of course the government says, well, we're not going to do this, it's ridiculous. And then they resign in protest, and then it looks like the government's done some sort of U-turn, or, you know, they're not doing enough, and they just get slagged off. And then he goes and writes a book about it. So the book is just his national food strategy in language that people can understand and may even possibly read. And he thinks he can solve not only obesity, but climate change. And this is, I think, the only interesting thing about the book, really, is how people get these delusions of grandeur. I wrote a review about it in The Critic, which people can look at to see the details. But essentially, he wants lots and lots of clampdowns on food, including The flagship policy would be a tax on salt and a tax on sugar to get the food companies to take it all out, because we all know they only put it in for fun. It doesn't need to be there. It's not like it gives it any flavor or anything. And then climate change is even a pretty much totalitarian view of climate change. He doesn't think people should be eating cows or sheep at all. But he also doesn't think this is going to be an issue because artificial meat is going to take over the market in a very short space of time and put all these farmers out of business. And when the farms go out of business, he's going to get the state to employ the farmers to do odd jobs, like, you know, fixing dry stone walls and creating little bits of wetland and all the kind of stuff people who live in London think that, you know, farmers should be doing. And they'd be custodians of the land. And in particular, they'd be building. Yeah, they'd be creating wild forests. They'd be planting lots and lots of trees because he wants to turn the countryside into this giant carbon sequestration project and try and reverse climate change. So people won't be eating meat, in his view. Farmers won't be really doing any farming. There'll be quite tasteless food because he's taxed all the main ingredients. And he genuinely thinks this is not just kind of possible, but absolutely essential. And his book is only interesting, I think, insofar as it shows you the thought processes, many of which do link logically one to the other, but when taken together, end up with kind of quite insane ideas.
Now, I'm keen to move on to our postbag section. Before we do, Chris, you gestured there to the point about how these food advisors tend to always come in a very similar mold and tend to come with very similar opinions. Why are they always like this, in a nutshell? Why do they always, the only way they differ is they just seem to get more mad over time in their prognostications about how we should all live and eat? Why is it the fact that even a conservative government seems only able to appoint these kinds of people with these kinds of views on these issues?
Because they're the right kind of people. They are, I hate to use the word elite, it's kind of lazy, but, you know, they are members of the new class, as Martin Durkin would call them. You know, they are good chaps and they're appointed on the good chap principle. And they're not politicians as such, they're not necessarily interested in party politics as such, so they're seen to be independent thinkers, but within a very narrow kind of range, right? So they're not slavishly party political, and they might have one or two ideas that government agencies wouldn't come up with, but the only reason the government agencies wouldn't come up with them is because they're totally either impractical or politically toxic. So in terms of getting blue sky thinking, you don't really get it from these people. They think they do. They're deluded enough to believe that they are actually saying the unsayable. But they're not. They're only pushing the political envelope or pushing the open window a tiny little bit. And in Dimbleby's case, not even at all. I mean, everything he said about obesity policy pretty much is in line with what Public Health England used to say. It's in line, in many cases, with what the government's already done or is doing. And his idea about turning farmers into, you know, stewards of the land is basically what the DEFRA's policy is now. You know, post-Brexit, the subsidy system is based on giving farmers odd jobs to do that have nothing to do with producing food and everything to do with protecting newts and bats and hares and stuff.
On that vision, we should move on to our post-bag section.
Post-bag, post-bag, post-bag.
It's bulging, eh?
So we've got two questions here from our listeners have been sent in, one for Liam, one for Chris. Liam, starting with you, going back to our discussion of blasphemy, we've got a question here about essentially how we should tackle this particular problem, asking should we have a zero tolerance for blasphemy laws, and particularly pointing to what do you do about the fact that often the way these things are enforced is by intimidation, it's by death threats and so on. And we can always, it's easy for us to talk about how people should be braver in the face of all that, but how practically do we deal with this particular problem, given that the fact that it is fueled by intimidation, as we say?
Yeah, well, I mentioned how some of this has been imported to Britain through Pakistani diaspora, but I don't know if you saw that is he Danish, the far-right guy who likes to go around burning Quran, Rasmus Paludan? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But he got banned from the UK because he said he was going to come to Wakefield and do his usual stunt. You know, we've used those measures even against, believe it or not, those measures got used against Tyler, the Creator. I don't know if you know the American rapper, kind of for a stage persona. You know, these measures about banning people were more or less for kind of religious preachers who, you know, were pro-domestic violence and things like that. Those were the reasons that these were introduced. But we ended up using them against Tyler, the Creator, or like kind of right-wing North Americans like Lauren Southern. But we're not using them against, you know, there are preachers and leaders that kind of enjoy a quasi rock star status in Pakistan among these kind of zealous blasphemy movements that come and visit the UK, and they do mosque tours, and they do, you know, they come and do all sorts of things, and it's actually quite helpful for their fundraising efforts. And that's part of, it's not the whole way, but that's part of the way that this has come to Britain. So my question would be, you know, if we're banning Tyler the Creator, Lauren Southern and Rasmus Paludan, why are we not using these measures against these preachers that are coming here? And, you know, maybe they venerate people like Mumtaz Kadri or Asad Shah's killer and the guy from Bradford. You can go on their Facebook pages and see this kind of stuff. It's just that, you know, I'm not saying it's easy, it's difficult. They use terminology and languages and things that we don't really understand. And it would mean monitoring these people's Facebook pages to see when they're coming to Britain. But, you know, it's possible. And that is one tangible thing that we could do to kind of, you know, curb this a little bit. There has been a suggestion of, you know, should we treat blasphemy allegations as you know, kind of in the way that we treat, you know, Chris mentioned like hate speech and things like that before, or, you know, even treat it as inciting violence. Because, you know, if you do make a blasphemy allegation, the next logical step is violence, right? I don't know how I feel about that. I kind of share Chris's view that, you know, freedom of speech is under assault from multiple angles at the moment, so I'm loath to add to that. But it's just one possible suggestion. But I mean, you know, on the local level, on the ground, there's also just, you know, actually being aware of these things and being aware of these dynamics for police forces and councils and councillors, and knowing whether, you know, the people they're going to visit and do an interfaith event with, you know, are they on a Saturday at their interfaith football event and then on a Tuesday holding a sermon about why blasphemers should be killed? You know, it's just simple stuff about whether that is an appropriate community partner or not.
Chris, question for you here, which is from John Bryan, who is a good friend of the show, writes for Spiked. I read that Chris is about to win a £1,000 bet against Jonathan Portes. So you should tell us a little bit about that bet for those of us who haven't been following this particular wager as closely. But also, John wants to know if there's any other bets you'd like to place with Portes or anyone else.
Okay. So the bet, very simply, 5 years ago, Jonathan Portes was commissioned for some reason by the Human Rights Commission to produce a report looking at the effect of government tax and benefits policy. And he said that if the government didn't do a U-turn on implementing universal credit, child poverty, which was then at 29% after housing costs, would rise to 21% by 2021. This immediately seemed incredibly implausible to me. It hadn't been above 30% since the Tories had been in, and I don't think it had ever been above 34%. So it was an enormous increase in a very short space of time. And then I read his report, I just thought it sounded like nonsense. So I said, I'll bet you that doesn't happen. We came to an arrangement. He reduced it a little bit. He said, well, okay, 37%. If it goes above 37%, you pay. So that was the bet. We then had to wait 5 years for all the data to come in. And the figures came in this week, and it is still at 29%. So it hasn't increased whatsoever. And he's had to pay up. I mean, all credit to him for taking the bet. I often think that these people, they make nonsense models just to try and, you know, produce something that can be used as a weapon against the government and try and get the government to U-turn on various issues. We saw it with COVID, most obvious recent example. You know, if you get rid of all the restrictions, we're going to see these incredibly high rates of infection and death and so on. And we know that just didn't happen. You know, for Freedom Week or with Omicron. I tend to think the more politically, you know, powerful a model or a prediction, the more likely it's going to be wrong. To answer John's question, what would I like to bet on now? I think the economy is incredibly difficult to bet on at the moment. In retrospect, I wish I'd found someone to take a bet that inflation was going to, you know, hit double digits, because I was pretty convinced it would. Well, maybe not double digit. I was convinced it was going to be pretty high, certainly well over 5% because of the money printing. I'm sure I could have found someone probably like Portes to take that bet, but that's okay. Easy to say with hindsight. I would be tempted to have a bet that the UK won't be the poorest, you know, won't be the worst growing economy over the course of the next year, like everyone's saying it's going to be. But even that, I wouldn't be too confident with, because, you know, apart from anything else, we're increasing corporation tax. So I don't know. There's nothing obvious, and I only like to bet on things where I think at least they're obvious.
So what are you going to spend the money on?
Well, I've got to have my car serviced and MOT, so that'll probably take up most of it. Nothing too glamorous.
There we go. But nevertheless, it's as you say, good for him to fess up. We're fast running out of time. But thank you so much for both of your time today, Liam, Chris. let you get back to your day.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.